Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look today at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, who comes by the first Wednesday of every single month of the year. And he's back again, although with us by phone this time. Scott, are you there?
I'm here, Larry.
Oh, great. And you are at the Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation?
Yes, I'm at Max McGraw, which is just a wonderful spot, just a few miles up the interstate from O'Hare outside Chicago, about an 1,800-acre research center, education center, and hunting preserve. And we're here teaching a national workshop for wildlife agency employees who have no prior experience with hunting.
And, oh.
So it's a national hunting awareness program, and it's just going great, and we're having a good time.
Oh, that is good to hear. Well, I tell you what, we've got lots of things we can talk about. I know that cougar sighting in Dunn County, no doubt that was a cougar.
No doubt at all. Apparently there are good photos from trail cameras, tracks. A lot of DNR folks have been involved in tracking the animal. I lost track of it through the email string just after Christmas, and I think with snowfall and whatnot, the animal may have moved a bit, but and of course they can cover a lot of ground, but likely still in Wisconsin. So that would be in the last year and a half or so the third well documented cougar we've had. So this adds further credence to the long-standing series of rumors, sightings, and other things we've had over a very long period, as you well know, Larry.
Absolutely. One of the nice surprises is the number of golden eagles here in the state now.
Yeah, that's an interesting situation. I think there was very little. I mean, the party line for many years was that golden eagles were a western counterpart to our bald eagle population, and that if a golden eagle strayed in here, it was a rarity and would be treated as such, and you really needed to travel 1,000 miles or more west to see them with any regularity. But as it turns out, once people started to look, and this was largely an effort stimulated by rumor, I think, somewhat like the cougar situation, the National Eagle Center in Minnesota dispatched a lot of volunteers along the Mississippi River. And now the thinking is that on an area along a river, maybe 5 to 20 miles inland on either side of the Mississippi from, just below, say, I-94 from Eau Claire to Minneapolis down to a few miles below Prairie du Chien, that roughly 100-mile stretch, there are probably upwards of 100 golden eagles wintering in that habitat every year. So if people are interested in seeing them, it's no longer a matter of traveling to Wyoming or California. There's quite a good number right here in Wisconsin and on the other side of the river.
One other item before we go to the phones, the DNR pulled its 16-day deer season proposal. A lot of criticism there from hunters and hunting organization. What's next? We go back to the 9?
Well, at least for the time being, I think next year we're likely to go back to the 9-day. But what there are so many permutations and combinations of the hunting seasons and opportunities now, Larry. There's a lot to sort out over the next few months, and there's a big difference between what's likely to happen in the bulk of the state as opposed to what's likely to happen in the southern part of the state where chronic wasting disease management is still an issue. But there's still a lot of there will still be a lot of fallout and discussion about the past deer season and the fact that the harvest was down substantially and what that means and why and where we go from here. So it's a work in progress, and I think it'll be a while before it's sorted out.
Let's take some calls. Mary in La Crosse, we turn to you now. Hi, Mary.
Thank you very much. This might be a little bit convoluted, and it's going to end up with a question that maybe Phil Pelletieri can answer too. But the Monday before Thanksgiving, I live in an apartment that's built on a concrete floor, and 10 years ago when it was constructed, there was a code violation. They had to let it sit in the winter. There were cracks in the concrete. And the floor had been replaced once. Water started coming up through my floor that was actually coming through the neighbor's apartment. Anyway, ripped everything out, had to take all my appliances out, including the dishwasher. When they did, there were mouse droppings on top of my dishwasher. Discovered them in a drawer with my dish towels and those kind of things. So when the project was all done, which took a good 3 weeks because they had to rip everything out, start all over, discovered that I did have mice. So the guy that did the reconstruction put down those little traps where you catch a mouse and then you throw the whole thing away.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to tell you the truth, I was afraid to pick one up, that he did catch one. And thought the problem was solved. And then a couple weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, had to take everything out of the cupboards because I discovered that there were mouse droppings and also a terrible odor that must have been urine. Took everything out of the pantry, scrubbed everything, put everything back, thought the problem was solved, and then last week I discovered more mouse droppings. I went and got Decon. Okay. Then had been seeing mouse droppings in my pantry again. Yesterday morning when I went to get crackers out for lunch, I didn't see a dead mouse. After lunch when I went to put things away, there was a dead mouse. And to tell you the truth, I freaked out. Okay.
So
then, along with that, this is my pantry. It's a full-length pantry with many shelves. There were ants. Could not I have taken everything out? Everything in there was already clean from when I did this pantry, scrubbed it before. Could not figure out where ants were coming from. So I have a bunch of questions. Number one, can I leave Decon all over the house? This apartment complex was cheaply built. I know from listening to you before that now I need to take steel wool, push it in places around pipes where they had put nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if I put Decon down, how long will the Decon last?
Well, let me, this is a long and convoluted problem. I'll just start by saying that for anyone to be able to fully close the book on a mouse problem and say, okay, I've solved this mouse problem and I'll never see mice again, is extremely difficult and unlikely. And I'm hoping my wife isn't listening because we've got the same, you know, we live out in the country and mice, the white-footed mice and deer mice and so forth, coming in the fall and roaming around the kitchen with mouse droppings being found, drawers, pantries, and so forth, is almost a part of life in most homes, especially in the country. Your situation is complicated by, as you say, the structural issues and the fact that you're in an apartment, so you don't have complete control over the integrity of the building. But you're right, to the extent that you can mouse-proof your unit and convince the owner or manager to mouse-proof the entire set of units, that will certainly help. But it is a Herculean task to think that every opening, you know, the size of a dime, or any place where a mouse can reopen access, like the gaskets on the base of a garage door or anything like that, that are almost impossible to completely close. You know, you're almost better off to do the best job humanly possible and then accept the fact that an occasional mouse is going to get in, and at that point, you both have the materials and are willing to use one or more types of mouse traps and one or more types of mouse baits or poisons, and then deal with the problem as it occurs. And it can be an ongoing battle.
Yeah.
You know, a good, the single-use mouse traps that you suggest where the mouse goes in, you can't see it, you pick it up, you throw the whole thing away, they work, and they certainly help people who are a bit mouseophobic, live or dead, but they're not as effective in catching the mice as the plain old simple snap-type wooden base mouse trap, baited with a little bit of peanut butter. And you'll just have to be diligent with those things or get some help in using them, and eventually you'll get the upper hand, especially as you do mouse proofing and the owner, as I said, the owner or manager does it. As far as the ants, having ants in the winter, especially the, you know, the little tiny things, the sweet ants that are generally coming from outside nests, that shouldn't be happening this time of year. If you've got larger black ants, it's my impression that those, especially since you said you had water and problems, Phil should comment on this at some point to you, but that sounds more like carpenter ants to me, and that can be a big-time problem with structural integrity more than just the aggravation of having an ant on the counter. So
yeah, there you have it.
There you have it.
And as Phil says, the ants aren't there causing the damage. They're there because of the damage. So you need to identify, if it's those large ants, you need to identify where you've got the water issues take care of the damp wood or whatever it is, and you'll take care of the ants. There you have it, Mary. Thank you for calling. Jim in Presque Isle, we're going to go to you now. Hi, Jim.
How you doing today?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Okay. My question is, I do quite a bit of winter exploring, skiing, backcountry skiing, snowshoeing, and there's a couple areas up in the UP and a couple in Wisconsin. I do quite a bit of bird watching, especially with the, you know, with the migrating birds through the winter. And I've noticed, I'd say the last 6-7 years, I've spotted a couple of great gray owls up in the Porcupine Mountains and the Estevan Pine area up by Copper Harbor, Michigan. And also snowy owls coming through over by the Newman Springs Wilderness area by Park Falls and the Kate Walter Wilderness. I don't know if you're familiar with that at all, over by Presque Isle. I'm just wondering if that has to do with global warming. I do notice, especially in certain areas, especially hardwood forests, after a first snowfall, if I'm out there skiing or whatever, I notice a lot of mouse activity. You know, you can see them through the snow and burrowing the little holes through the snow. And I'm just wondering if this food supplies get a little better down in this area that they're migrating down.
That's typically what draws them, isn't it?
The appearance of those northern and Arctic owls in Wisconsin is generally keyed to periodic food shortages or low rodent populations in their normal habitat further north. And
right.
When that happens, then the owls are driven south, and there are periodic eruptions or invasions of these owls. It attracts a lot of media attention. A few years ago, there were great grays all over the place in northwestern Wisconsin and in the Arrowhead of Minnesota, and people were traveling up irregular routes. Go here, you're likely to see them, and they're spectacular birds.
Oh, unbelievable.
And probably at any given time, there may be a few of either species here and there, and, you know, they are seen by people who are out persistently and getting into remote areas, but it's the periodic or cyclic invasions of those birds, when we even see snowy owls on the construction equipment around Madison and so forth, that really gets everybody's attention and makes the media. But they are spectacular. It's not an uncommon thing, and when there is an invasion, it can become a rather common thing. So
Now with the heavy snow, I know, like with barred owls, with heavy snow, they have a hard time getting the mice through the snow if it's too deep, right?
They do, but voles and things like that will pop out of the snow occasionally and move across the surface. And there are wind-blown areas, and they often hunt along roadsides where there's some exposure due to plowing and so forth. So certainly deep snow makes things tough on lots of different predators and lots of different animals, but it's usually manageable.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Doug in Wisconsin Rapids, turning to you now. Hi, Doug.
Good morning, guys. Question is, we have a lot of turkeys up in our area, the two-legged walking in the woods type.
Yep.
And I'm a golfer. I'm not a turkey hunter. But a few years back, somebody wanted to introduce a rattlesnake to take care of the eggs of the turkeys. Well, when I'm going around in the woods looking for a golf ball that's apparently off by somebody else, of course, then I have a pause by saying, I don't know if I want to go in there if there are going to be a rattlesnakes around up here.
Well, I'll tell you what, Doug, you really don't need to worry about that, because that whole deal about moving rattlesnakes around to control turkeys, whether it's in Door County or Wisconsin Rapids or anywhere else, is an urban legend.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
No truth to it.
No truth to that whatsoever in terms of the snakes being moved around, and in terms of distribution of rattlesnakes, both the timber rattler and the Massasauga or swamp rattlesnake are very limited in distribution, primarily southwestern corner of the state, and not an animal you need to worry a whole lot about running into.
You're safe.
Good. But the other side of the coin is, isn't there a possibility of opening up the season so that they have a little bit either longer season or more seasons for these turkeys?
It's exactly what they're doing. Over the past, this past year was the first experiment in consolidating 30 or 40 turkey management zones into, I think, just 7 or 8, and simplifying the regulations. And in 5 of the large zones, including most of southern and southwestern Wisconsin. The turkey season was actually extended this past season experimentally until literally just last weekend at the end of the year. So turkey hunting was open in the fall for virtually the entire fall. And then, of course, the normal spring season, five-day periods for gobbler hunting are also in place. So there's a tremendous opportunity or window of opportunity for turkey hunting, and about all the pressure that can be applied to the birds is being applied.
Here we have it. Thank you very much, Doug, for calling. You can join in as well with your question or comment. The number 1-800-642-1234. Have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly. You can also email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Talking today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll take some more calls. Again, the number for you to join in, 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Kathy in Hubertus next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Scott, I emailed you about a mystery creature in our house earlier this autumn.
Mm-hmm.
We still have it. I sent pictures last night, which you probably haven't seen. It's done damage. It's very clever. We haven't managed to trap it with either rat-sized sticky traps or snap traps or live traps, putting all sorts of different food in that it got into the kitchen before we started putting everything away.
Mm-hmm.
You thought it might be a flying squirrel or possibly a small raccoon.
Mm-hmm.
We're to the point where we sort of decided, okay, we're not going to worry about what it is. We just want to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband is talking about poison, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on putting poison out for it.
Well, it's very difficult to target the appropriate poison. And there are not many poisons or toxicants legally registered for most types of wildlife other than rodents, rats, mice, and things like that. That's not to say that there aren't lots of things that will kill these animals, as they would kill us if they were misapplied or taken incorrectly. So the first issue is it's still important to have a pretty good clue what you're up against, so that you can make the decision that you actually have a poison or toxicant available, and then how and where and when to apply it.
You need a trail camera inside your house.
Yeah, that's what I was. I don't know. I don't remember the exact correspondence. So you sent some pictures recently?
Just last night. You probably haven't seen them.
I've not seen them. I don't have computer access here at the workshop, but when I have a look, I assume your number is probably on the email.
Yes.
I'll get back to you when I get back in the office early next week, and we'll talk a little bit more about the pictures and what they may tell us, and then I can perhaps give you a better recommendation. But as Larry points out, a lot of recent mysteries, both in and out of structures, and especially outside, have been solved by the use of motion-sensitive or so-called trail cameras. And, in fact, that's something we're going to hopefully talk about later this morning on the program. There's a new book on the subject. But if there is an area in the house where this mystery animal has made a fairly regular appearance, then by borrowing or renting or even buying a motion-sensitive camera from someone and positioning it properly, you're going to get a picture of the darn thing, and then we'll know for sure what it is. and then again, once you know what it is, that's a major leap forward in terms of resolving the problem. But the short answer to your original question, that out of frustration, you know, blanket placement of some highly toxic substance in the house is
not a good idea.
Probably not the greatest idea.
Yeah. So hang on, Scott.
Hang on. Let me look at the pictures. I'll try and do that before. I won't be back in Madison until Friday, but I will get back in touch with you. And if I have not by midday next Monday, then rattle my cage. Okay?
All right. Thank you very much, Kathy, for calling. And, you know, you mentioned the book. Why don't we talk about that book on trail cameras, a new book?
Yes, it's a very new book. It's called Spies in the Deer Woods. And I brought a copy of it down here to talk about in more detail, which is down in my room while I'm up in the conference room. So you may be able to Google it, Larry. I know you have a computer there to get the authors. The first author's name is a very lengthy, complicated one, which I'd rather get exactly if you can find that. But nevertheless, It's a paperback. The broad title is Spies in the Deer Woods, but the subtitles are really how to monitor wildlife in your woods. And I think the focus is on deer in particular and how you can use these trail cameras to facilitate deer management on your property and, of course, deer hunting by getting to know certain animals that you might be interested in targeting. But it's really neatly illustrated with lots of really nice photographs from various trail cameras. And it's the most lengthy and in-depth treatment I've seen about how to use these cameras toward a positive end, more than just, ooh, that's a cool picture. Certainly you get the cool pictures, but there are things that can be done with these pictures that may not only help you, but also help in the concept of this notion of citizen science we've talked about before, where people with trail cameras are going to be able to collect a lot of useful information that will help, if we can kind of consolidate or collect this information, useful information on the distribution and abundance of various species, especially rare ones, like the cougars that have been captured on trail cameras. And it's just a neat thing all the way around. They're a really neat tool. The technology is evolving quickly. The prices have come down a bit on some of the cameras. And a neat thing to deal with, and this book lays it out all very nicely.
And the author is Dick, two authors, Walt Larson is one. The first author is Dick Scorzafafa.
And that's why I wanted you to find it on Google.
Scores of Fafa, Fava, Fav. It's Scorzafava. Scorzafava. If you just put in book Skies in the Deer Woods, it's going to pop up on the on your search.
Yes, and it is a paperback, so it's relatively inexpensive. And I think I had a couple copies shipped very quickly from Amazon or in the local bookstores. May very well have it now as well.
Yep. All right, let's turn to Pete in Merrill. Hi, Pete.
Hi. Love the show. I told my dad I was seeing golden eagles. I have a problem with turkeys in the woods up in Forest County where I've been hunting since the middle 80s. I walk into an oak grove, and I used to see deer, and I was able to shoot a lot of deer with my bow and arrow in there. And since turkeys have come into play up there, it's like they've taken over the whole oak grove, and I really don't even see deer there that much, but I'm always kicking turkeys out of there. And I'm wondering, you know, with all this hoopla about all the deer population being low, if it's being brought up about turkeys eating the deer's food and then less deer make it through the winter because we've added what I think is an invasive species to the North Woods, turkeys.
Well, that's a very interesting series of questions, Pete. Let me offer a couple things. I've heard concern expressed from some hunters about not just the notion of potential competition between the species, but also the fact that, gee, I was quietly sitting there in my tree stand, and all of a sudden a flock of turkeys came marching through just as I was watching a deer, and there was a heck of a commotion, and boom, the whole scene just kind of fell apart. While there may be a little bit of that, and certainly turkeys and deer do eat some of the same foodstuffs, I think the burgeoning population of turkeys in the North Woods is a surprise and a mystery to a lot of people. No one expected turkeys to move as far north, as fast, or as vigorously as they have. And I've got to still think that the right combination of winter weather with a couple back-to-back winters is going to set the turkeys back a bit, although they frankly seem to be flourishing in the North Woods, and to a lot of people's surprise. And that may in part be due to the same thing that's assisting the deer in the North Woods, and that's the widespread practice of feeding. There's a lot of stuff, food stuff, particularly corn, being put out on the landscape for feeding deer, which the turkeys are benefiting from, and that's probably helped both species maybe maintain their populations and move into areas where otherwise they might have been on kind of the ragged edge. The fact that deer numbers and deer sightings and deer hunting success are all down in the North Woods right now, I don't believe has any substantive relationship to the number of turkeys up there. There are lots more important things going on that have influenced deer numbers in the North Woods, particularly recent winter weather.
Yes.
That's probably the major factor. Hunting patterns of people, more concern over some predators, particularly more recent concern over the numbers of black bears, and of course wolves have always been an issue. But a lot of these things all need to be teased out and examined over the next few months in relationship to what we were talking about earlier with the reduced deer harvest, and with many hunters reporting the same thing you just said, that in areas where, including your group, Larry, and some of my friends and many others, hunting in areas that they've been in for many years have historically had good success, and this year and perhaps in a couple of recent years, the deer just haven't been there. And there are a variety of things that go into that, but I really don't think turkeys are a big part of it. Maybe in some areas a minor contribution, but not a big issue.
All right.
Well, I don't know how it could be a surprise to the DNR that there's turkeys up there when they worked in coordination with Whitetails Unlimited to release them in all the spots they did up there in about 2001.
Yep, that's certainly true. And turkeys were released all the way up to the Bayfield Peninsula. So the fact that they're there is not a surprise. That was intentional. What I think people are surprised about is that they've really done as well as they have.
Yeah, I think
that's
the
big surprise. Many years leading up to the most recent successful reestablishment of turkeys that started in the mid-1970s. Prior to that, there had been lots of releases of turkeys here, there, and everywhere, and generally they were met with failure. Now, there are some other factors involved, but I still think that in the North Woods, where agriculture is the big issue, where the habitat is quite a bit different than you'd find in, say, the southwestern Wisconsin with many more mast-bearing trees and that kind of thing, that to see turkeys doing as well as they are in the North Woods is still a surprise. And whether it's sustainable is anybody's guess. Turkeys have proven to be a whole lot more adaptable and capable and resilient than we thought.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I have a cabin in northeastern Price County, and in roaming around up there this fall, I saw more turkeys than anything else. I mean, driving down, oh, there's some turkeys. There's another turkey. Oh, there's a turkey over there. And it really is, it just seems weird to see them in that environment. But they're doing really well.
Thanks, Pete. Thank you for calling. Kurt in Suamico, we go to you next. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. My wife told me not to be uncouth in my wording. But I've got a lot of squirrels in the backyard under my feeders who are leaving spots of pink winky tinky.
Pink urine. Pink urine.
Urine, okay, that one's all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if I've got a bunch of squirrels with kidney disorders or if they're eating those little tiny crabs and it's somehow going straight through them.
Usually with urine stain that's anything other than what you typically think of as the yellow snow situation, it's related to something in their diet. Whether it's rabbits or squirrels, you know, feeding on different things, you can get everything from pink and red to blue and assorted other things depending on what they're eating. But it's also possible that there's something going on by way of, you know, if the squirrels look otherwise healthy, this is probably unlikely, but it's also possible that there's something going on physiologically or illness-wise that may put a little blood in the urine and give it a pink stain. But for the most part, it's usually related to their diet, and if they look otherwise thrifty and you're not too concerned about it otherwise, I don't think it's much to worry about.
All right.
Okay, thanks.
Except to watch out for both the yellow and the pink snow.
Yeah. Okay. Christine in Wauwatosa. Hello.
Oh, hi. My question is regarding proper bear encounter etiquette, because I'm, like, go up north a lot, and this mid-August when I was kayaking and at twilight, and I entered a really narrow, shallow channel just before I went into the lake, and I heard some crunch over in the bushes, and I thought, probably a deer, but it was a bear who jumped out, like, really hadn't smelled me. I must have been upwind, and it entered right in front of my kayak into the water, and I saw it first. And I just froze because I couldn't do anything. And my first thought was hoping that there were no cubs because it was closer than was comfortable for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondering, what do you do in a situation like that? Luckily, it freaked out when it saw me and decided to turn around and run back into the woods, and I skedaddled across the lake. But then I've noted the rest of the time I was up there, if I wanted to go out and look at the stars at night, I started to go like, oh, God, you know, is there going to be another bear, you know? What do I do when I run into bears up there, which seems to be more frequent than lately?
Well, a couple considerations. First off, most human-bear encounters end the way you describe. Once the bear knows you're there, bear's very interested in being somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are a lot of bears right now. The bear population doing extremely well. There are bears in close association with humans, and therefore there are bears who are going to become more and more habituated to humans, especially around campsites, open dumps, places where, God forbid, people are feeding them, and those kinds of things. And those are the ones that start to get into trouble. So you see bumper stickers, for example, especially in other states, say a fed bear is a dead bear, in recognition of the fact that a bear that's being fed and habituates to people is going to get itself into big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So on average, the average bear and the average encounter, the bear goes the other way. But there are certainly circumstances where that may not happen for a variety of reasons. And in that case, then you fall back on different strategies. You may, for example, decide, much like hikers in the West, you want to get a can of pepper spray to carry with you. Some people, because of bears and other concerns, and whether this is justified or not, are now when they're out hiking or checking the mail or walking the dogs, they're armed. Those are a couple of possibilities. But also, if you're going out and just going for a walk at night, although it may minimize your opportunity for positive wildlife encounters, making a bit of noise, you know, making it very clear to anything that's around that has the sensitive hearing and sight of most wild animals that you are there by talking, whistling, carrying a bell, anything like that is also in the long run going to be helpful. But
yeah.
I'd also suggest that you maybe get on the computer and do a little Googling. There are some really good publications out from organizations in the North Woods and one from the Forest Service that deal with the notion of living with black bears. And you can contact the USDA Wildlife Services folks in Rhinelander, the DNR folks, particularly in the Park Falls office, and get your hands on a set of guidelines or a little publication that will deal with the whole spectrum of your response to certain situations of encounters with bears, and that should put you at ease.
Okay.
But the long and short of it is, although it's a little disconcerting to bump into a 200 to 400 or 500 or 600 pound animal in the woods, still incidents that result in bad things are very, very, very rare.
Mm-hmm. There you have it.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, Christine. And Robert in Madison, on to you.
Hi. Last week we had some visitors from Vermont, and they were staying in a bed and breakfast near my home on the west side of Madison, off Monroe Street, as a matter of fact. I'd never been in that B&B, and I said, show me that place. And we went there, and in the courtyard was a huge tree, which suddenly filled up with perhaps 20 crows,
mm-hmm.
all screaming and yelling. And we noticed that there was, well, they were all looking at what appeared to be a big brown ball of feathers.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, it decided to take off. And by God, it was a bald eagle.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never seen one within the limits of Madison. And I'd like to know how frequent that is.
I can tell you right off the bat that just before the ice completely froze over on Lake Monona, we live on Lake Monona, we had 5 bald eagles that were kind of fishing and hunting couple hundred yards out from. In fact, one sat up in the tree right next in our neighbor's tree. So there were 5 for sure on Lake Monona. just a couple weeks ago.
And at about that time last week, as I was sitting at my desk in Russell Labs on the west end of campus, I glanced out the window, and one flew by the window, headed for University Bay on Lake Mendota. So it's becoming more common. I mean, eagles are nesting along the lower Wisconsin River and in other sites in southern Wisconsin now. And, of course, it's been well known for a long time that many birds winter along the Wisconsin River, and then you have bald eagle days and so forth.
Yeah,
and prairie
I go up to Sauk City and watch them, you know, at the dam there. But
well, now you don't have to go as far.
No, come on over to my place.
As long as there's open water, eagle numbers are doing very well, their distribution's expanding, and if there's some open water for them to fish in, then I think eagle sightings around the Madison Lakes and along the Wisconsin River, and really any place where they have some water access, will become more commonplace.
And we, just to mention, I believe Eagle Watching Days is not this coming weekend, but the weekend after next. And Randy Jurowitz and Jeb Barzin will be on the show next week, probably Wednesday, to talk about eagles and to talk about Eagle Watching Days, Robert. So I hope you tune in.
Great.
Well, thank you very much. I was really blown away by that.
Yeah, that's great. Isn't that a great sight?
But that behavior that you saw with a large number of crows mobbing that eagle, that's very common crow behavior whenever they pin down any type of raptor, be it hawk or owl, especially owls. They just don't get along very well, and their strategy is to mob the owl and harass it and literally drive it out of the area.
Thanks, Robert. Bob in McQuantigo, on to you now. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I live on a marsh, and I'm having problems with garter snakes and milk snakes coming up from the marsh, mostly on the south side of my house where it's sunny, and they climb up under the siding and get into my basement.
Hmm.
Do you have any way to discourage them, keep them away? Is there anything?
Well, there's a couple possibilities. I mean, for one thing, if you're in an area like that that has good snake habitat, snakes are probably going to be a fact of life. And as long as that doesn't kind of unduly agitate either you or any other family members, notably a spouse, then the snakes are not, the species you mentioned, are not harmful in any way in terms of being venomous or biting or any such thing. But the shock value of finding one in the house, of course, is kind of like the TV ad, priceless. So you probably can't do much about the habitat attraction being near the good habitat in the marsh or the south side of the house where it's sunny and warm, being a nice spot for the snakes to bask or congregate. But I think this is a structural issue, and having not seen the house or the type of siding, what you need to do is solidify or eliminate any access points where the house sits on the sill plate. So if there's a bit of overlap of the siding on the sill plate, the nice thing about snakes is that, unlike rodents, I mean, no teeth or claws or anything else to excavate an opening or chew their way in or any such thing. So if you simply go along the sill plate, especially on that side of the house, and either fill any cracks or crevices with steel wool, or I think if there's...
I've done that. Steel wool, expandable foam.
You've tried the expandable foam?
Yep. I've done all that, and they're still finding a way in on that side of the house. I have actually seen them go under there and pulled them out as they were going in.
Well, where were you? Where did you pull them out from?
As they were going up underneath the siding.
Well, I think then obviously there's still enough of a gap there that they'll be able to force their way in. So I think that, you know, it's a matter of going back and reapplying or trying a different material. And if that's not working, then I think it's probably worth having a pest control operator who is familiar with snakes come in and have a look and see what material they'd like to put up there. I think if worse came to worse and the filling or plugging wasn't working, then I would either be taking a band of very small gauge hardware cloth, quarter inch or less, and what kind of siding do you have?
Aluminum.
Aluminum. Okay. Well, that complicates things a little bit, but attaching some type of a barrier from the outside surface, lower surface of the siding, to the actual foundation itself, and affixing that with whatever material is necessary. So there's simply no way those animals can get in. That's the long and short of it. The only other thing I can suggest is that there's one repellent on the market called Dr. T's Snake Away, the letter T, Dr. T's Snake Away. It's a mixture of ground sulfur and naphthalene. Comes in a big canister. I think you could probably find it online. And that's designed to be sprinkled along the base of a foundation and presumably prevent or present a scent-based barrier for snakes that are attempting to enter a building. It's very specific on the label as to what species of snakes it's effective on, but that might be worth a try as well. But I really think the long and short of it, the only long-term foolproof solution is the snake proofing, and it may just take a more concerted effort than has worked so far.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And you can call us with your wildlife question at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. And let's hear from Bob in Madison next. Bob, hello.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been fishing rather aggressively the last 2 years, Wingra Creek, downriver from Lake Wingra to Lake Monona, and I have noticed the beavers have come to town amongst the eagles and the coyotes. The beavers are now here. And I saw a dead one up last spring in the pond below the new Wingra Dam by St. Mary's Hospital. And I have begun to notice as I run my dog at Quan Park there behind the Goodman Pool that the ever-telling rings around the trees are beginning as these beavers feast on those.
Mm-hmm.
Anything an ordinary citizen can do to send these critters on their way, or what, do I just have to live with these trees falling into my fishing hole?
Well, that little area of Wingra Creek from the dam on Lake Wingra downstream for a few blocks has been a hotbed of interesting wildlife activity.
Indeed.
For a long time.
It's beautiful.
It's a beautiful little stretch. I remember one outbreak of beaver activity, probably 20 years ago when they got in there, and they were felling all the trees right along by Thorstad Chevrolet there on South Park Street.
Right.
And then eventually I think the animals were removed. They do come back periodically, and they do what they do. They fell trees. And that will likely only be viewed as a problem by some entity greater than you as an individual. In other words, a neighborhood association, a commercial business along there, something like that, where all of a sudden it's, hey, we just don't want to deal with this anymore. And then at that point, working with the city and with the DNR, I'm guessing they're not that difficult to remove. They can be captured in a variety of ways and be removed, but it will only happen when some group of people or entity judges the amount of tree felling to be intolerable.
Okay.
And what I'm saying is that as an individual fisherman who is being inconvenienced, you haven't probably reached that level of clout yet.
Okay.
But also along that stretch of creek, that's where we've had in past recent winters a pair of otters meandering around in there that attracted a lot of attention. That's also another hotbed spot for eagle sightings and, of course, the muskie spawning in the spring there below the dam. That's really a neat little place. So some people will argue that the beavers are a natural portion of the animal community there, and some won't. I would also urge you to perhaps talk to the folks at the Arboretum. Get a hold of the arboretum ecologist and see what their thinking is on the matter, because I know they've been concerned about it in the past as well.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Thanks very much for calling. And there's a new dam there. It'll be kind of fun to see how the muskies do on this new dam. It's going to be pretty cool. And an email here, Scott, from Mike, who lives in Waukesha, and says, first, if seagulls been around in the numbers we see nowadays, I often see hundreds of them flying around the Frame Park Dam area. And secondly, he sees seagulls that look like they've been bred with ducks. For example, a seagull tail will be brown instead of the normal black with white polka dots. Comments on those two questions?
Well, the seagull is kind of a generic term for a variety of different gulls. There are many different species, and their plumage changes with age. So young gulls, for example, whereas an adult herring gull or a ring-billed gull or blackback gull is a beautiful, sleek, black, gray, and white bird and so forth, the young ones are ratty-looking, mottled brown and gray and so forth. So what he may be seeing is either different species or, more likely, young birds within whatever common species he's dealing with there. As far as the numbers of gulls, gull management has become quite an urban wildlife management concern, particularly not so much that there may be many more than there once were, but because they've tended to concentrate on flat-roofed buildings, at landfills, around airports, around dams and open water, where concentrations of any large birds become problematic. So there are large numbers of them around. Whether that means more than in the past or not, probably not. And what he's probably seeing is just a young bird within the flock of larger gulls.
Let's turn to Mike in Rice Lake now. Mike, hello to you.
Good morning, guys. About 2 hours ago, I was driving on Highway 93, just about half a mile north of Independence, and off to the side of the road, a couple hundred yards, is a row of trees on a frozen over creek, and I noticed a large flock of birds, and I slowed down to look, thinking they were turkeys, and in two trees about 100 feet apart were a total of 17 bald eagles. And I could not believe me. I stopped, and you know, it didn't look like I could see anything, dead deer or anything else, or any idea what 17 bald eagles would be doing, you know, in a place far from open water. And
sounds like some sort of a meeting. That's certainly a neat thing to see. Anytime, I mean, one eagle is a pretty spectacular bird, but when you start to see them in large aggregations, it gets pretty exciting. But usually, there's some, although it may not have been obvious, there's some explanation for that aggregation, whether there was a pond in the background that someone had an aerator in and there were fish available, or whether there were one or more deer carcasses that they had found or been feeding on. I don't know what, but usually when you see an aggregation like that, especially in a place where you don't expect to, there's some food-based explanation.
Yeah, gotta be food. And actually, Jean in Hainesville, Illinois, listening in, emailed, said she saw an eagle soaring over her home in Hainesville, Illinois, just west of Grays Lake, mm-hmm. on Sunday. It was an early Christmas or late Christmas present. She says she's never seen a bald eagle anywhere near this area. She's an avid bird watcher, wondering how unusual it is. And as we've been talking, I guess the range is kind of expanding a bit.
Well, the range and the numbers are both expanding, and also we have a circumstance developing. It's been mighty cold, and we're due for more snow. I'm kind of cut off from the civilized world here for a few days, but I understand there's more snow in the forecast. So as ice even covers some of the river feeding areas, and more snow, more ice, more cold, the eagles are moving around more looking for a food source. So more eagles, weather conditions, more distribution, everybody's going to be seeing eagles.
And Elaine lives in Bayfield County. Common belief is that bear populations are increasing, and that certainly seems to be the case. Has there been any research on possible effects deer and bear baiting may have on bear reproduction?
Not that I know of. I mean, in terms of bear numbers, the most recent research, and this was just a couple of years ago, that interesting study that we've talked about before, Larry, where these little boxes of bacon laced with tetracycline were distributed all over the state, and ultimately a mark recapture study was done with bear samples turned in by the bear hunters that were marked from them eating the tetracycline-laced baits. But anyway, the upshot of was, by a mathematical computation, a pretty good population estimate, probably best we've ever had, came out that suggested that, gee, here in Wisconsin there are probably at least twice as many, if not more, bears than we thought we had. And the DNR commissioned that study. They were happy to have it, and they quickly responded by increasing the number of hunting permits and really kind of changing bear management around. So the first issue is there aren't more bears than there were. We just didn't know we had as many bears as we do. Whether or not the fact that they're being baited or fed or whatnot has increased the number of cubs per female or the number of cubs that survive. Probably, A, I don't know of any immediate research on that, but B, I would guess probably not. The baiting is a seasonal issue, and of course when most of the deer feeding and so forth and the foodstuffs are being put out during the winter months, the bears are down for hibernation anyway. So that isn't a factor. So I don't think that's a major issue. Whether bears are doing better because some at least have figured out that, hey, deer fawns are a pretty good source of food for a short window of opportunity in the spring, or other things going on like that, remains to be seen. But nevertheless, there are a lot of bears.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. He'll be with us up until 12:30 today, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at the wildlife habiting the state of Wisconsin and sometimes beyond the state of Wisconsin today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening in. Lots of callers online. We have lots of emails as well, so we'll get right to it. And turn to Glenna in Lyons. Hello, Glenna.
Hi, how are you today?
Thank you. Fine.
Good. I'm driving, so I'm just going to ask my question and then listen on the air, okay?
Okay.
It's about badgers. I know this is a badger state. We've lived in Lyons for about 10 years. I've never seen evidence of a badger anywhere dead along the road, nothing. And I'm just wondering, are there badgers in Wisconsin?
Yeah, there are.
Yes, Glenna, there are badgers statewide in Wisconsin. They're distributed statewide, but at low densities, and they're rather secretive. So, I mean, I've been in Wisconsin for 34 years now. I've not seen a live one in the wild. I've seen an occasional roadkill. That's how most of them that turn up at my office or in the wildlife department at the university come to us, is that someone finds a roadkill. And I would say that over that 30 years, that's maybe happened 5 or 6 times.
Yeah.
So they're out there. When people know they're around, find a network of dens. I've had people recently provide beautiful pictures of badgers from trail cameras once they mount a camera near the den. So the upshot of it is they are here. They're distributed statewide, they're at relatively low densities, and even where they occur, they're reasonably secretive. So you could go a long time, as I have, and never see a live badger in the state.
I've never seen one either. Seen some dead ones, but never live. Beverly in Rushford, Minnesota, we are on to you. Hi, Bev.
Hi. I love red squirrels, and they love me. And I've gotten a very adorable herd of red squirrels who are infesting my house between the walls.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
In the summertime, I had a carpenter come out and do this and do that and replace this and replace that to where we thought they were getting in. And by George, that wasn't where they were getting in. And now when it's very, very cold, and I feed birds year-round, outside, my little red squirrels seem to be multiplying, and they have a stash of walnuts, black walnuts that they have on the upper floor of my garage, and they bowl with them just like in a bowling alley. It's really entertaining. You can time them as to when they enter the garage and roll them across the floor. But you know, as entertaining and as good as they are, I realize
you had it.
Yes, well, they're. You know, I heard something on PBS that was about England, and there's a society there that is looking for red squirrels because
they
the
grays
are running them out. I'm just the opposite here.
Well, you certainly shouldn't. Red squirrels are a cute little rodent and so forth, but to a point, whether it's red squirrels, flying squirrels, gray squirrels, or any other squirrel, once they get into your house, they're all squirrels, they're all rodents, they have tremendous jaw strength and chewing capability, and they can do a lot of damage, as well as the nuisance value that you've already described of their nocturnal bowling. So the issue is you don't want to tolerate them in the house. If you feel you've been beaten in terms of structural modification, One of the issues may be using squirrel-proof materials, simply finding, say, an old soffit board that they've chewed through and replacing the soffit board may not do the trick because they're quite capable of chewing right through that again, even with a new board.
Mm-hmm.
So it may mean a matter of making the repairs and then essentially armor plating them with hardware cloth or sheet metal.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, if there are existing holes and you want to get them out, there are one-way door devices that look kind of like a wire mesh live trap, but are actually mount over a hole in the wall with a couple of expandable wings that are just stapled up, and the animals go out the little tunnel, push underneath a spring-loaded door, and then as they exit, the door closes behind them, and they can't get back in. And that gives you a window of opportunity to make some repairs after you think you've gotten them all out. Now, if you're less concerned about that in terms of their well-being, then you can certainly deal with them in a lethal way.
No, I don't want to do that.
Okay, well, if you don't want to trap them, I mean, they're very vulnerable to a rat trap. They're a little bit smaller than a rat, but a rat trap works very well, and you could thin them out very quickly that way. But if you don't want to deal with them that way, then you have you have little choice but to encourage their exit through the use of the one-way doors, potentially, if it's above the garage, a good application of a few handfuls of naphthalene flakes that may also encourage them out, such that you can do the type of repairs that I just suggested and make sure that those are armor-plated so that once the squirrels are out, you can still continue to enjoy them around the yard, but you don't have to worry about structural damage or nuisance problems in your house.
And good luck, Beverly. Thank you very much for your call. I want to turn to Harold in Rice Lake next. Harold, hello.
Hi, hello. Yes, I have a problem with woodpeckers pecking holes in my cedar siding, and they create these round holes about the size of a bird, and they excavate the insulation, and it's a real nuisance. So I guess my question is, what can I do about it? And when you're offering any suggestions, would it help to go with a darker, more solid color stain on the cedar as versus the lighter, more natural, transparent look that's on there now?
I doubt that the siding color will make a whole lot of difference. However, there may be some additives if you're thinking about restaining anyway. In years gone by, we used to recommend an additive called pentachlorophenol, which was a very highly toxic wood preservative. But for whatever reason, the woodpeckers didn't seem to like it. If that was cut into a stain as it was being applied, it provided some repellency for quite a while. But penta was banned quite a few years ago, and whether the paint and stain contractors have an alternative to that or not, I don't know. You'd have to inquire wherever you're buying your stain. I don't think the color is going to make a whole lot of difference. I've seen them attack homes in virtually every color, as well as natural tones. So you've hit on one of the most difficult to solve problems of all the various wildlife problems I deal with. Woodpeckers are a source of great frustration. Are the holes that they're making all on one exposure of the house?
They seem to be predominantly on the southern exposure.
Sometimes the birds are particularly tuned into a particular exposure. And are they generally concentrated high on the house, closer to the soffit than the ground?
Yes, it's a fairly high house. It's like two stories, and they're on
here are a couple of alternatives. None of them are great. Have you done anything yet in terms of scare tactics, like an owl decoy or a scare eye balloon or pinwheels or streamers or anything like that?
Well, we did have some streamers on there, and they've kind of blown away, and I don't know how effective they were.
Well, they're marginally effective, but they're probably better than nothing, but you have to be very zealous about the application of these scare tactics, using, you know, rotating them, using several at the same time, but making sure that they stay in place. And that may give you some relief. But either at the same time you do that, or you could try it beforehand, plastic mesh bird netting, which is readily available at any garden center, can be draped from the roof line down over the side of the house. This stuff comes in huge sheets if you need it. And then essentially allows you to screen off, say, the upper half or upper third of the siding by angling it down from the roof line to the siding. And that simply prevents access to that portion of the house by the woodpeckers. If they are really tuned into that exposure, in other words, you need to catch a break here, simply covering that exposure may lead them to go elsewhere. It may also lead them to move around to the east side of the house or the west side of the house or whatever, in which case, well, you gave it the old college try, but it didn't work. So if the netting and the scare tactics fail, there are no good repellents that I know of. Repairing the holes only means they'll open more holes. So at that point, the upshot of the whole situation is if you're, you know, willing, most people value woodpeckers as a, you know, a nice component of the bird population, and in some cases people are feeding them, but in recognition of the severity of the problem, it is possible to get a permit. These are protected species now, but it is possible to get a permit through the USDA Wildlife Services Office in Wisconsin. The state office is in Sun Prairie, and the state office number is 837-2727. It's a 608 number. And they can issue you a permit for destruction of one or more woodpeckers, and then depending on whether you're in a rural area where gunfire is legal or whether you're in a suburban area where you have to use trapping, then you can legally destroy the number of woodpeckers appropriate to the permit. And it may only be one or two birds. It usually is. And then once you've dealt with those two birds, you may not have any woodpecker problems for years. It's very erratic. In some cases, houses that look very vulnerable have no problems. Other houses that seem only marginally vulnerable have terrible problems.
Right.
So it's unpredictable. But you can go that permit route, and although, again, most people don't like to think about actually killing a woodpecker, for some problems like this, that's, in my experience, been the only solution.
There you have it, Harold. Thank you very much for calling. And we'll turn to Richard in Black River Falls next. Richard, hello to you.
Good morning. I had a what you might call a rare experience with a eagle. Have you ever seen that commercial where the eagle comes down and picks up the bird? I mean, not the bird, but the fish.
Yes.
Out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
Well, while I was up in Chautauqua, I was watching this eagle do this almost every morning. And one day while I was fishing, within 5 feet of my boat, the eagle came down and took out a pretty good-sized bass.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just, I just sat there in awe to see something that close actually do it. And I'm also want to tell you that I had a badger on my farm when I had my dairy farm.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there for about most of the summer and then disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw him several times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So they are in Wisconsin.
Yep. They definitely are. Well, that's a great story, Richard. It's always fun to see eagles, and when you see them that close.
Yeah, I released a small pike that I caught on the lake at our cabin late last summer. I was out paddling around in the evening in the canoe, and I released the small pike, but it apparently was temporarily stunned, and I let it go, and I heard it splashing, but I turned around to tie on a new lure or something, and all of a sudden, it's wham, literally just a few feet behind me, and as I turned, whoa, there's an eagle right there that had come down and grabbed that pike, and then dragged it over to the shoreline and sat there and ate it. It was a neat experience,
Richard,
as was just described by Richard. But, boy, it sure gets your attention.
It sure does. Well, Charles emailed us and noticed that he'd seen a crow pulling apart a rabbit about 5:30, 6 in the morning. And wondering, he thought that crows only were diurnal. Are they nocturnal as well?
Generally speaking, crows are on roost from dark to dawn, and this was before light.
Yes.
Before, well, I mean that's pretty unusual, but you know they do get an early start certainly. So
and with snow on the ground, it would be
with an early a full moon or with snow on the ground, they might be out a little earlier than normal, or they might have been disturbed on the roost. But a rabbit carcass lying around that a horned owl killed and didn't finish, or whatever else happened to the rabbit. Crows are very opportunistic, very capable birds, and they're not one to pass up a free meal. So nothing too unusual there except the early start.
Someone was wondering if there's a figure out for the total number of bear killed in 2009 in Wisconsin.
I'm guessing that harvest figure is available, but I don't have it in front of me. I'm guessing it's, well, I shouldn't even guess. I imagine you could find that online on the DNR website.
Look, yeah.
But if by the same token, the listener can go to the DNR website and just probe around on the hunting results and probably get the number. You know, typically, we were talking before the population surge 2,500 or so. I would expect the number to be 3,000 or 4,000 or more, but I just don't know for sure.
Let's turn to Tom in Green Bay. Tom, hello to you.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to make some corrections about turkeys in northeastern Wisconsin.
Okay.
Number one, back in the late 60s, there was still a population of turkeys on the Nicolet National Forest.
Yep, the Marinette population hung on for a long time.
Well, that wasn't Marinette. You're talking quite a distance inland, and that was studied by people from Stevens Point.
Okay.
1980s, we had a tremendous immigration of turkeys from the large population up in the UP.
Mm-hmm.
And up there, their DNR was feeding them in feedlots in the wintertime. We had a tremendous amount of snow, and there was a mass migration. People watched turkeys running across the Menominee River in flocks.
They were storming in from the UP.
Yes, and those hooked up with the birds over in the Lakewood District, and we've had a very large population of turkey through Marinette County, up into Florence County, into O'Connell County, and even into northern Brown County from there, long before the DNR started putting in introductions.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, they do have a negative effect on deer. Some of the isolated on the west shore of Green Bay where we have oak stands, there is not an acorn to be found. And the deer hunting there has decreased remarkably since the tremendous population of turkeys. And you can take a look at Christmas bird counts if you want to see the number of turkeys being reported all up and down the west shore of Green Bay. They also are having quite an effect on herps, especially in the spring of the year, on wood frogs, which overwinter, and spring peepers, which overwinter in the soil, and also on salamanders.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's another success story for the DNR, but it's having a lot of ramifications.
Oh, yeah, and they'll eat small snakes and a lot of other things, too. I'm not sure that the issue of the success story, while the reintroduction is viewed as a success story in terms of, yes, there are turkeys back, they're widely distributed, many people are now hunting them. Some of the implications, especially in the North Woods, remain to be seen. So, good observations.
Let's turn to Joe in Oshkosh next. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I was listening to the caller a few back with the woodpecker problem, and I have another alternative if a person is willing to go up on a ladder. I had one drilling holes in my cedar siding, and my experience was that it was using the nest that it made as a roosting nest. And so what I did is I waited until after dark, and I put a ladder up quietly, and got myself a minnow net. Actually, in this case, was big enough to fit over the hole. I went up the ladder quietly and flapped the net over the hole, and the bird came right out into the net. And I put him in a box and relocated him. Now, I don't know if I don't know what kind of homing instincts they have. So far, it's been a few weeks, and he hasn't come back. I relocated him about, I'd say, 100 miles away, and I'm wondering if that wow. bird will eventually come back.
Well, I mean, woodpeckers are generally non-migratory, so that's a long way for the bird. That's a vigorous reintroduction on your part or relocation. So I think you stand a reasonable chance of the bird not coming back, either because it's disoriented, has found suitable habitat, or in the process of trying to get back met with some ill fortune in doing so. The problem, of course, is that, again, much like I described the alternative of trapping or killing the bird, and the necessity for a permit, again, from a strictly, you know, legal issue, capturing, handling, or moving a protected bird like that is not legal. It may work for you, but it's not something that I could recommend as a tactic without the necessary permits.
Okay. Well, it's a good thing I didn't give my last name.
That's all right. Not to worry.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling. And back to the badgers for a couple of minutes. Mike sent a picture. He said, in regards to the caller who's never seen a badger in the wild, even after finding an active badger den in Iowa County, I spent close to 20 hours over several days staring at a hole in the ground waiting to see them. Two cubs poked their heads out of the den for about 30 seconds. I managed to get a couple of photos, and he includes one of the photos, absolutely fantastic photo.
Cool.
Of two young badgers, a very close-up photo. It's really, really an... Mike, you did a great job. So anyway, and we got a couple of other emails from people who said they've seen them.
Is that badger photo on email, Larry?
It is, and we have his email. Mike,
forward it on to me if you would.
I will definitely do that.
Thank you.
And James and Baraboo, on to you.
Hello, gentlemen. Great program. A couple springs ago, I found a curious creature on our property. It looked like a snake, but it wasn't a snake. I did a little research and found out it was a glass lizard.
A slender glass lizard.
Yes, sir. And I see there's two fractured areas in the Midwest that still lives. One is central Wisconsin. The other one was central Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if this is the same species or if you could tell me a little bit more about this. I couldn't find too much on the animal, but...
It's slender glass lizards are, I mean, they look for all intents and purposes. 99 out of 100 people, if you saw one on the ground, would say, ooh, it's a snake. It's a limbless lizard. It is a lizard, but has no limbs, moves, acts, and behaves like a snake, but has all the other features of a lizard with eyelids. And if you actually, did you pick it up or just see it or...
Yeah, I picked it up, and
a snake is very pliable and will wrap around your arm and all, but the slender glass lizard feels rather stiff and brittle.
Yeah, this guy was stiff.
Yeah, that's the nature of the lizard versus the snake. But they are quite rare, and that's probably a report. It is typically central Wisconsin. You're not that far out of the... what's considered the range, but that's probably they're not seen often enough so that if you, if you're willing to provide the location or information to the Bureau of Endangered Resources, they're always interested in collecting new distributional information for rare species like that.
Thank you.
It's a neat find. Yeah. They're striped. They have long, dark stripes, but it's a lizard, not a snake.
And James, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And to Mike, who called in about seeing bald eagle near Independence, they're, according to Donna, they're there every year at this time through spring looking for fish on the creek, which parallels Highway 93. Scott, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Larry, and thanks to all the great listeners and callers today. Have a good one.
You too. And he'll be back the first Wednesday of February, and we'll do this all over again. Look forward to it. Tomorrow at 11, Joy Kirkpatrick and Greg Lawless of UW Extension talk about a new program called Annie's Project. And then Macintosh support specialist Joe Rhodes of Madison talks about Apple computers and accessories. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.